The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are a number of tools and research papers advising teachers on how to best engage introverted students in school. With K-12 education increasingly focused on group learning and collaborative skills, an active, noisy classroom can be a real challenge for introverts, especially when they're the teacher. Michael Godsey is a teacher based in St. Louis Obispo, California, also a contributing writer for The Atlantic, where he wrote about the high burnout rate for introverted teachers and what a loss that is for solitary or withdrawn kids. Michael Godsey, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So you've met a number of introverted teachers. Do you think they knew what they were getting into?
I think a lot of times there's a sometimes a romantic expectation that there's going to be a lot of reading. I think a lot of readers get into teaching, and I'm an English teacher, so even more with English teachers. Reading and hanging out with people that enjoy reading and book clubs and writing quietly and grading papers, you know, under the lamp, things like that. And then other teachers get into it because they love working with kids. I think there's a broad spectrum, but I think those are the two poles there.
Mm. Well, you mentioned in your article a couple of studies suggesting that introverted teachers are in danger of burning out. What are some of the big challenges for them?
Especially the first 2 years, it's constantly interacting with people and in meetings and in a lot of small talk and a lot of collaboration. And the more introverted you are, the more that you're not ever anti-people. It's just exhausting. And especially the first 2 years, I wouldn't call myself an introvert, and it just exhausted me. It was just new meetings because you got to meet new people. So you got to meet the parents, you got to meet the administration. You're constantly being observed, department meetings, union meetings, collaborative meetings within your department, and then they get you a mentor because they think that helps. But then you're meeting with mentors all the time and senior teachers and things like that, and it's tough. And it's funny, once you get tenure and nobody's observing you as much, you get a lot more quiet time. But you got to make it through that first couple of 3 years, and that's when teacher attrition is just really high. It's 41% or something in the first 2 years.
Yeah, so orientation is tough on anybody, but especially introverted teachers. Anecdotally, I've talked with a lot of teachers who've mentioned, you know, there are a lot of meetings, there's a lot of training and workshops, and there's this pressure to be always active and engaged with students and parents. You point to a term in your article coined by the Harvard Business Review. Have we, Michael Godsey, reached collaborative overload?
I think in some environments, I hear it from a lot of people, I see it in little spots. I like the high school I'm at. We haven't overloaded here, but in just like the what you just cited, they're talking about the business world, and I've talked to lots of people in business that are forced into group tables and group rooms where they're always in a collaborative situation, and they say it just exhausts them. It's the same way, I think, with teaching, except we go from those meetings right into another classroom where the kids are expected to be engaged in a collaborative manner a lot of times.
So in general, teachers do have to learn how to recharge. How is it different for introverted teachers?
I think they need to know that it's okay. A lot of them, I read a lot, they're like, whew, you just described me, and I thought I was weird. Like, I thought it was just me. I thought there was something wrong with me. I mean, I didn't know about it until I studied a lot more and started talking to teachers, and then I started seeing teachers quite a bit in their room, sometimes the lights off at lunchtime or after school, just decompressing. And usually they don't know that that's common. They think it's them or there's something wrong with them. And they don't stick up for themselves and say, hey, this is something that I really need. This is a thing. One or two teachers I do know are very aware of it, and they're much more healthy about it.
So do they last?
No, my favorite, that's what I was kind of worried about. I mean, we lost one of the guys I know that spent 2 hours a day in his room quietly all the time. He's moved on to a quieter school. Another guy quit. He was a brand-new teacher. I mentioned Mr. Lovegren, who doesn't work around here, but he said he finally quit after 12 years. He couldn't handle it anymore. And he was very conscious of it. He knew, like, I can't take it anymore. I have to have the space, and I'm not getting that space.
So what does that mean for kids?
Well, the bummer for for the kids is that I think they're losing that type of teaching, which is really good for kids. I notice that now that I'm more aware of it, I notice how much my kids like at least a designated quiet time, that they like to interact, they love to socialize, but when I tell them to be quiet and read for a half an hour or we do a quiet activity, I'm recognizing they really like it. And so if we lose those introverted teachers or those that are sensitive to that, I think we lose that for the kids. And also I think they lose role models. Like I said, I think there's that idea that I like to read, so I'm going to be a teacher when I grow up. Mm. Or I like to think and reflect in my journal, and so I might want to be a teacher when I grow up. And I think that the more they see these role models that are very active and facilitating and collaborating, and that they'll think that's what teaching is. And then I think that will just get more and more extreme as we progress.
Do you remember, Michael, there was a book a couple of years ago about the power of introverts? I'm trying
sure.
to remember the woman's name. Susan Cain.
Susan Cain.
Right. She is an introvert herself and made the point that they are not as highly valued as extroverts. So it is a much bigger problem. How do you think to encourage introverts as both teachers and students within the school system?
I just think recognition and awareness is really important. There's still the stereotype of that they are being withdrawn or they're antisocial or they're lazy. And I think there's a lot of teachers in particular, but I think it's every profession, that feel bad when they say, well, I just spent a whole day with kids and now I'm in a meeting where I'm supposed to do an icebreaker and get engaged in a lot of small talk and I'm just exhausted. So I think it's just the awareness more than anything. And the article I cited had a lot of good advice for schools. John Spencer wrote a piece on how to give those teachers the space and just to be aware. One of his pieces of advice was just ask them, like, what's best for you? Where do you get charged up? Where are you the better teacher? I see it with coaches, too. It's even more dramatic. So you'll see really extroverted, excitable coaches, because I coach basketball and baseball, and other ones that are deeply introverted. And as long as they're playing to their strengths, the kids love them and they play hard for them.
Michael Godsey, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Michael Godsey is a teacher. He's based in St. Louis Obispo, California, also a coach, and he's also a contributing writer for The Atlantic. That's where he wrote about the high burnout rate for introverted teachers. You can find a link to read the article at wordofmouthradio.org. Some people build their dream houses. Others deliberately build nightmares. Why? Pure unadulterated spite. People who have both plenty of money and a vast supply of vengeance can erect the built equivalent of a giant middle finger aimed at neighbors, siblings, town officials, or ex-spouses. Garishly painted, squished into tiny lots, or sitting empty in remote places, they are called spite houses and are often the stuff of legends. Patrick Sisson is editor at Curbed and wrote about 12 such houses created with anger and angst. And Patrick, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks.
So how would you define a spite house?
Well, there's a lot of different examples. I think it's something that is really just meant as a way to inconvenience or just disappoint your neighbor. It's really meant as a bit of sort of built revenge that, of course, by the nature of being a home, ends up sticking around for a lot longer than people may expect, or at least longer than people are still angry.
So is there a typical look to a spite house?
I think one of the things you find in a lot of these homes is that they're very small. They tend to take advantage of small spaces in between buildings or next to buildings. A lot of times these are built because there's disputes over property. So in order to get back at somebody else, they'll, you know, build right along the front of the property line or build in an alley as a way to sort of get back at someone and inconvenience them. So small tends to be one of the main features.
And that was the story with the Boston Skinny House. What's the story behind that?
Well, that was built by a Civil War vet to get back at his brother. He was promised a big plot of land that actually they were going to split. And unfortunately, when he was away at war, his brother basically built on about 3/4 of the land. So in order to get back at his brother, he took out the remaining plot, which people thought wouldn't be developable, and built an incredibly small, thin, tiny home to sort of piss him off, basically.
There's another one in Cambridge that's also a little teeny tiny home just sort of squished into a lot. What's the story behind that one?
Yeah, that one was built by Francis O'Reilly in 1908. He was trying to sell a little plot of land he had that someone wouldn't buy. So when they rejected his offer to sort of anger them and anger the people around them, he just built this little home, which is actually, as far as I know, still being used as an interior decorator's office. So it has found a use beyond just this guy's sense of revenge.
There are other spite homes that are defined not so much by their structure, but by their paint jobs. What are some of the examples of that?
Yeah, there's a couple of my favorite. There's one in Topeka, Kansas, that's actually located right across from the Westboro Baptist Church, which not surprisingly was painted in rainbow colors by a man named Andrew Jackson, which I think is a great form of revenge. But I would have to say, of all these homes I've written about, my favorite is one in Kensington, which is a real upscale neighborhood in London. A woman had planned to renovate her basement, and neighbors found out, brought it to the attention of the planning council, and her plans were rejected. So her revenge was to paint kind of garish red stripes on the front of her white house. And as sort of like a final like sort of twist in the revenge, she left the last stripe unfinished. So walking by, I have to see this, you know, little part unfinished, and kind of just digs into their head the whole, you know, for days and days.
Yeah, there is just a sort of like a image of, you know, people pulling up in their raised fists, you know, against these spite houses.
Right. Yeah, or coming by with a paintbrush wanting to finish it, but not being able to.
Well, it seems like, okay, yeah, have you ever heard that expression, harboring a resentment is like taking poison and waiting for the other person to die?
Yeah.
But there's a kind of like, there, it's a lot of time and money and planning must go into creating a spite house. I mean, any sense that it's satisfying for them, the builders?
I think for the people, especially for the people who do paint jobs, I think it sort of is, because, you know, in a lot of ways, you don't actually have to look at it. But the other people who are building sort of small homes, it seems just painful at best. If people have the money to do this and not really care about where they're living, then I think they do get a certain degree of satisfaction. The story that kind of started this all for me was there was a New York Times essay about what's called the Pink House, which is also in Massachusetts. A man, you know, in his sort of agreement with his wife, he promised to build her a replica of their home when they got divorced. What she didn't specify was where the home was. So we ended up building this in the middle of a salt marsh. So it was completely isolated. I think he got a little bit of satisfaction with that because he actually didn't have to live there.
Yeah. A lot of people talk about that home because it's on the way out to Plum Island.
Exactly.
And that is the thing, you know, that these homes must become sort of legendary in places.
Yeah, I think they've all become, you know, sort of tourist attractions, things like that in their areas. I mean, who wouldn't want to see such a weird, crazy contraption?
I was looking at the photos inside of Boston Skinny House and thinking, very attractive, actually, on the inside. Now that there's this movement of people who are living in smaller spaces, are some of these spite houses acting against their owners' original wishes and actually becoming desirable places instead of those with the big middle finger?
You know, I haven't heard of anybody deliberately, you know, going out of their way to buy or live in one of these homes. But yeah, I think you're onto something. I think the tiny home trend would suggest that these are actually maybe ahead of their time in a way.
Oh, can you ever imagine building one of these yourself?
I think if I was that angry at someone, I'd want to get as far away as I could.
Well, Patrick, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Patrick Sisson, he's news editor at Curbed, where he wrote the article Spite Houses, 12 Homes Created with Anger and Angst. And you can find a link to see all of those houses and his narrative to them. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. They are the most literal signs of desperation. Cash for your gold. We buy ugly houses. And for those in the upper crust, cash for your Warhol. Quick settlements, no questions asked. That sign began popping up in American cities during the Great Recession. The prank slash art installation is now a fake business with a real storefront and genuine competition. I'll let Jeff Hargadon, he's a conceptual artist, financial advisor, and the brains behind Cash for Your Warhol, explain. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. But what a great story here. This Cash for Your Warhol thing, it's been going on since 2009. What started it for you?
Well, we were in the middle of the financial crisis, and I kept seeing so many of these signs, cash your house, cash for this and that, everywhere. It seemed like an assault on our senses from all telephone poles all over. It just popped in my head one time, what about the 1%? What about their liquidity needs? And the phrase cash for your Warhol just popped in my head. I thought, well, I think I'm just going to make a bunch of signs and see what happens.
So people called you?
Oh, yeah. The first set of signs that I did actually had my mobile number on it, which was a mistake. I thought everybody would be in on a joke, but no, not everybody was. I eventually migrated to a Google Voice number where all the calls are archived.
I go to your website and it says cash for your Warhol has been business for several months.
That needs to be updated, I guess.
But it says it will help you manage your finances, increase liquidity, manage child support obligations, and get on with your life. So people were called. Were they in on the joke?
There were the calls that I get are curiosity seekers. They are people who just want to know if it's a real number. The people who want to talk about the project. And I get a surprising amount of people who actually have Warhols that they want to sell.
Really? Well, so is that the measure of success for you, how many people you fool?
I'm not sure how to define success with this project. For me, it's just being part of a broader conversation about art and artist commodity, and it's a little bit anti-establishment. It's really about how art has been commodified. And the more people talk about that, the more successful it is. But I'm really not trying to fool people. That's why I put my cell phone number on there on the first sign. I figured everybody would get it.
And now you have a storefront. So what's in there?
Well, the store is designed in such a way that for people who have Warhols that they want to bring in and sell, they now have a place to go. We're exclusively dealing in Warhols. And the way the store is set up is it's meant to look very much like a pawn shop. It's also really an art installation that can be viewed from the sidewalk. So while I'm not there, people can walk by and pretty much see the whole thing.
I noticed that I was looking at photographs on the Boston Globe. They had a little slideshow of the store. And they're fake checks made out, cash for your Warhols made out to people. I'm assuming they're fake. Let's put it that way.
Well, I will say this. Some of the stuff in the store is real and some of it is not real. And I leave it up to the viewer to decide what's what.
Well, now you have competition, apparently. As I was looking you up online, there are other cash for your Warhol businesses that are being set up.
That is right. Friends of mine were Googling cash for Warhol and noticed that one site, Cash for Warhols, with an S at the end, had popped up. And the website is actually near replica of my site, except it's a real business. It's run out of California. I actually hired a lawyer to present them with a cease and desist order, not because I'm so mad, but because I thought it would be kind of fun for a fake business to try to stop a real business from, imposing on my fake business. And it's actually worked. We just heard back from them recently. We're in the process of negotiating a settlement, and we're pretty pleased with the results. And in fact, the whole process of the cease and desist order might end up being another spin-off of the project.
Well, I was thinking that. I also read that there's going to be a show of the signs at a gallery, I think, in Philadelphia or something like that.
Yeah, and we actually was in April of 2015, we had a show of all the signs that have been designed at that point, and it was really fun to see them all on a wall, framed up, all dressed up for the big show.
So, okay, so you've got a storefront now. You've actually got a cease and desist business against a real business for getting in the way of your fake business. Where do you go from here, Jeff?
I don't know. My philosophy is if I have an idea and it sounds reasonably good, I'm going to put it out there and just see what happens. Mm-hmm. I don't really expect anything to be financially successful or critically acclaimed. If I have an idea, I want to throw it out and enjoy the process and kind of see where it goes. And this project has been, it's been amazing. Some of the things that have happened as a result of it. And it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't just made up that initial set of signs and my cell phone number on it and started putting them on telephone poles.
Mm.
So it's been really enjoyable.
So you're doing it. I mean, I can't help but think, but Andy Warhol would think this is pretty funny.
Well, I never knew Andy, but people, I know, I've come to know people who did know Andy Warhol, and they tell me that he would have enjoyed it.
Jeff Hargadon, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jeff Hargadon, he's a conceptual artist and he's a financial advisor from Somerville, Mass. Cash for Your Warhol now has a storefront at Inman Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There's much more on the store, including a slideshow that's from the Boston Globe. There's a link to that at wordofmouthradio.org. Passing through rays from outer space may sound like science fiction, but in fact, hundreds of particles flung from outer space pass through our bodies each minute. They're called cosmic rays. For decades, scientists have wondered where they come from and what could possibly be propelling them toward the Earth. Now, they're getting closer to finding out. Producer Ross Chambliss brings us the story.
Any kid can make this kind of a two-bit cloud chamber. First, you take a piece of dry ice, then a largemouth jar.
This is from a 1957 TV program called The Strange Case of the Cosmic Rays.
There you are. Cosmic ray footprints. You can't see the actual flying particles, but you can see their tracks.
This was one of about a dozen science shows made by Bell Telephone a few years after the launch of Sputnik. They were made to get American kids interested in science.
And I'll never forget the one about the cosmic rays.
That's Gordon Thompson. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Utah. And he studies cosmic rays for a living. It's a pretty young field of research. People have known about cosmic rays for barely over 100 years. In 1912, an Austrian named Victor Hess set out in a hot air balloon with an electroscope, a tool used for detecting radiation. Thompson says that the idea was to test the prevailing theory of the time that natural radiation was coming from the Earth.
And so what he did is he went up in this balloon, and if the radiation was coming from the ground, his radiation detector would see less radiation.
Victor Hess rose to 15,000 feet, almost 3 miles high. But instead of less radiation, he saw more.
Because it was coming from outside. It was coming from above.
The rays weren't coming from the sun, the moon, a planet, or any single star. Tell them why, Doc.
Well, because observers in every part of the world reported a most curious thing. The ghostly radiation was the same by night as by day, hitting each spot of the Earth continuously with equal force from every direction.
See, which meant they couldn't be coming from any single source. And so the amazed detectives were confronted with super rays whose hideout was the biggest ever imagined. The great open spaces of the entire universe.
The frustration has been that over the years, they seem to be coming from everywhere about the same amount.
This is Pierre Sokolsky. Just like Thompson, he's also a professor of astronomy and physics at the University of Utah. I spoke with him while touring a telescope with other scientists.
So anywhere you look in the sky, there seems to be about the same number of cosmic rays. But that can't really be true forever, because they have to be coming from someplace.
Okay, I'm conducting the experiment.
Apollo 17 astronauts traveling to the moon were among the first to experience cosmic rays outside the atmosphere, where the radiation is stronger.
Oh man, there's a good one, the left eye right in the middle. It's almost a purple flash, it's still going.
They wore special box-like helmets designed to let them better see the strange light flashes, cosmic rays, passing through their eyes. They reported to NASA whenever they saw a flash. On average, it was every 3 minutes.
Right in the middle of my eye, and it's coming out from behind a horizon, and then it disappears. It's gone.
Okay. We got all that, Gene.
But some cosmic rays are even more powerful. There's a special class of cosmic rays that are very rare called ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. They have energies greater than 1 billion billion, or 1 times 10 to the 18th power, electron volts. They can pack the power of a fast-pitched baseball hurled at 100 miles per hour. Scientists suspect they are heavy particles, like carbon or iron nuclei. Since they're tiny, you wouldn't feel it if one hit you. But that's not to say these particles are gentle.
These are the highest energy particles in the universe, as far as we know, at least the ones that are bombarding the Earth. And we know they don't come from the solar system. We know they don't come from our galaxy. They're coming from outside the galaxy, and the question is where.
An answer to this question, where are these ultra-high energy particles coming from, would emerge partly because of a big argument between physicists that began in the 1990s. The argument was over a theory that predicts that there's kind of a cosmic ray speed limit on these ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. It's called the GZK cutoff, named after three physicists, Grayson, Zatzepin, and Kuzmin, who came up with the idea in the 1960s. The idea is a bit like predicting what happens to a bullet shot into a pool of water. Just as water molecules slow down a bullet, the GZK theory says that diffuse radiation in the vacuum of space will slow down high-energy cosmic rays as they traverse the universe. By the mid-1990s, American physicists had perfected a technique for studying the telltale signs of cosmic rays breaching the atmosphere, fluorescent flashes of light detected by mirrored telescopes. And they thought they were seeing evidence that this GZK cutoff was real. But at the same time, Japanese scientists were busy using their own techniques and getting very different results. They were not seeing any obvious GZK limit.
You know, it got so bad we would go to national conferences and we were treated like, you know, two prize fighters fighting it out in front of the public, and people were yelling for blood. It was just not a pleasant situation.
That became a big discussion or competition.
That's Hiroyuki Sagawa from the Institute for Cosmic Ray Research at the University of Tokyo. His group was using a large array of ground detectors to measure what are called air showers, basically the showers of secondary particles that cosmic rays create when they smash through air molecules up in the atmosphere.
And eventually we came to the recognition that we could yell at each other forever and not really understand why we didn't agree. Or we could work together, not just looking at the data, but actually bringing the two techniques together in one place.
It's better to combine those two detectors and see the same cosmic rays using both type of detectors.
So they did. They settled on a new testing site, Western Utah, desolate with dark night skies. The Japanese detectors covered 300 square miles of desert, while the American detectors scanned the skies above. By 2008, the project, simply called Telescope Array, had begun. After 7 years, the formal rivals agreed that GZK cutoff was real. But by happenstance, they also began to unravel an even greater mystery, where these incredibly powerful cosmic rays were coming from.
You could actually say, if I measure where this came from, is going to point back to its origin. And what we're for the first time beginning to see in the Northern Hemisphere is that at the highest energies, it's clustering right around the Big Dipper, which is a big surprise. Nobody expected the Big Dipper to be a source.
From the data they've gathered, there's only a 1.4 in 10,000 chance that this hot spot below the Big Dipper is not real.
Really, we have to be the ones who exhaust every other possibility before we believe it. And so we've been very careful doing our statistical analyses. And it is fair to say, because we've already published a paper on this, that this is very unlikely now to be a fluctuation.
Still, they can't call it a discovery yet. The cosmic rays they want, the most powerful ones, land in a square kilometer only once a century. So to gather enough data, they would have to either wait 7 to 10 more years or make their array bigger. So that's what they're doing. In the next few years, the telescope array will expand to 4 times its current size. It will cover almost 1,000 square miles. That's an area almost the size of Rhode Island. When completed, it will rival the Pierre Auger Observatory in Argentina, the largest cosmic ray observatory on the planet. As for what's throwing such powerful particles at us, scientists do have some ideas. The most prevalent is that violent black holes inside nearby galaxies are firing out these particles near the speed of light. These turbulent black holes are called active galactic nuclei, or AGNs. What astrophysicists are asking is, do they line up with where these superparticles are coming from? Here's Pierre.
And the evidence has been very confusing. Sometimes it seems like they're lining up, and then people take some more data, and they say it looks like they're not lining up. So this hotspot is the first interesting, strong statistical evidence that they're coming from some locality in space. And the question is, are there a bunch of AGNs behind there? It's a surprising place because that's not where the astronomers were looking to find AGNs. Doesn't mean they're not there. They just haven't been looking.
So let's just say that catching cosmic rays is not for the impatient. The notion of waiting years, even decades, for the universe's most powerful particles to plunge into the desert may not appeal to many people. Then again, everyone loves an epic mystery.
You know, that's one of the things that makes the field exciting. It's not cut and dry. I mean, 20 years ago, if you had told somebody that, you know, 95% of the universe is made of stuff we don't know anything about, they would put you in the loony bin, right? Now it's at the forefront of physics, you know, dark matter, dark energy.
Startling things can happen, he says, when you just connect the dots.
In this kind of science, we have to be open to all kinds of new things.
And that piece was produced by Ross Chambliss as part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 1933, somewhere in the Carpathian Mountains of Eastern Europe, a couple dressed in heavy winter coats stumble through a whiteout blizzard.
Any sign of our rendezvous, kid? I can't see a thing in this blizzard.
I think I see a sign up ahead. This is it.
All right, kid. Let's go in.
Molly, watch out!
Attila! Silence, you cur! These are my friends here! Then back to hell with you, you mangy beast!
That is the opening of Intergalactic Nemesis, Target Earth, a one-of-a-kind stage performance that is part sci-fi comic book and part live-action radio drama. Jason Newlander is producer and director of the show, which is coming to the Redfern Arts Center at Keene State College on February 6th. And Jason, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So listeners just get half the picture from listening to that clip. Can you describe how the show is actually performed on stage?
Yeah. So what we do, we call it a live action graphic novel. And in performance, we mash up comic book formats with radio play. So what the audience sees is a huge screen upon which we project the artwork from a graphic novel that I wrote. And we project it panel by panel without the word balloons. It's beautiful, full color, high resolution imagery. And then three actors voice every single one of the characters. A Foley artist creates all of the sound effects, and a pianist performs a cinematic score, and it's all done live and in front of your eyes.
So how did this begin? Was it a play, a comic book, a radio play, what?
Well, it actually got its start as a radio play. I can't believe I'm about to say this, but 20 years ago this year, some friends of mine and I in Austin, Texas, where we're from, literally threw together for kicks a radio serial that we called The Intergalactic Nemesis, and we performed and recorded it in a coffee house in downtown Austin, recording on an extremely highly technological form called cassette tape 4-track. And somehow, miraculously, managed to convince our friends at KUT, which is Austin's NPR affiliate, to actually broadcast this thing. And every time I brought it back, which was every few years, we would rewrite it a little bit and the audience for it would grow. And it sort of evolved into a sort of live performance of a radio play.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened was I got invited to bring it into the Long Center for the Performing Arts, which is our local performing arts center here in town, into their 2,400-seat theater. And
wow,
I just
that's
felt like
a jump
that,
from a coffee house, huh?
Yeah, a little bit. So I just felt like the venue was way too big for the intimate experience of watching a radio play be performed. And in a flash, in this meeting, I came up with the idea of projecting comic book artwork on a screen the size of the proscenium. And their response was, well, that's funny. We just bought a cinematic projection system and we're looking for reasons to use it. It took us about 15 months to create all of the artwork, which was by a local artist named Tim Doyle. And we premiered the show. More than 2,000 people showed up to the premiere and started touring immediately thereafter.
Well, all the right things lined up, it sounds like.
Yeah, just amazing. A dream come true for me, I'll tell you.
Well, there's something very retro about this whole thing, both the story, though it is a lady reporter set in the 1930s, you know, trekking, and the style seems to harken back to these radio dramas, you know, The Green Hornet or The Shadow. Is that part of the appeal?
I think so. I mean, for me, kind of my training in theater, my background is in theater, not in comic books or radio, really. But was thinking in terms of form and content coming together seamlessly. You know, taking this story that we set in the 1930s and using media that were invented in the 1930s has this kind of holistic feel to it. You know, something I hear over and over again from audiences is, why hasn't anybody done this before? It just seems so obvious when you see it.
Hmm. Well, yeah. People, of course, used to have to imagine it when it was on the radio, but we get to see the actors kind of playing things out. And one of the things for me, one of my favorite aspects of the show is seeing the Foley artist at work, you know, kind of like getting to watch the show and see the sausage made at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. But unlike sausage, this is actually quite a beautiful thing to watch get created. We kind of discovered this a little bit by accident, because when we originally did the show, none of us involved had ever done anything like it before. And it was also done extremely quickly. Like the episodes would get written, we'd rehearse the very next day and then perform it the day after that. So it was kind of thrown together. And that involved me and the guy who created the sound effects, Buzz Moran, rummaging through his kitchen and his closets to try to find things that made something similar to the sounds that were called for in the script. And a lot of those found things have stayed in the show because it's just so ridiculously entertaining to watch these household objects sonically transform into something you'd never expect. For example, there's a scene in which a train is traveling through the Alps. And to make that sound, we use, of course, a toy train whistle, but then also in conjunction with a box of macaroni and cheese shaken in just such a certain way that it sounds exactly like a train. It's amazing how well that works.
Jason Newlander is with us. He's a producer and director of a show called Intergalactic Nemesis. It's sort of a graphic novel on stage, which is going to be performed at the Redfern Art Center at Keene State College this week. I guess this is the thing that led a lot of kids to make, you know, radio plays after being inspired when they were kids.
Well, and that's actually part of our mission as we're traveling. So one of the messages that I feel like is implicit in the show is particularly for kids, is if you use your imagination and set your mind to it, you can do anything. Whether it's like taking, you know, tinfoil in your kitchen and making the sound of rain, or, you know, solving the problems of world hunger. I mean, all of it to me is about having an idea and just, you know, running with it. So, you know, we're living proof that that actually works.
Well, and it takes some attention. There's a lot happening on stage. When you first started doing this, was there any concern that audience members wouldn't know where to look? You know, they're seeing the images, they're seeing the Foley artists, they're seeing the actors.
That's a great question, actually. One of the inspirations for me on this project was when I was in college, the playwriting professor, I remember having this conversation about how do you make a play where people want to go see it over and over again? And this project is kind of an answer to that question, in that there really isn't any way to see everything that's happening on stage all at once in a single performance in the Intergalactic Nemesis, nor is that the point. And we trust that our audience is imaginative and clever enough to make their own decisions about it, you know? So for some audience members, and I'm one of them, I find, particularly when I first started watching this show, found myself gravitated to the screen and getting sucked up in the storytelling, much in the way that you watch a movie. Mm-hmm. But for other audience members, I've heard that they can't take their eyes off the voice actors, who are amazing, by the way. And for others, you know, like you, it's the Foley artist, you know. And then for the folks who are seated around the piano, our pianist is unbelievably talented. And, you know, watching him perform the score is a concert in and of itself.
Well, let's listen to just a little bit more of some of those voice actors you were talking about.
Ladies and gentlemen, you may have noticed that we are out of doors, sheltered by a large canvas. You may have noticed that a thunderstorm rages outside. You may have noticed that a giant metal rod juts out through the top of the tent. Now notice the curtain. rising behind me. Behind that curtain sits a device of unstoppable power, a mesmer machine designed to entrance this entire room. Ladies and gentlemen, behold the mesmographer.
Wow, that's a lot of full throttle to put out there.
That character is Mysterion the Magnificent, and in our story, he's the main bad guy, and also this world famous stage magician who specializes in hypnotism. The fun of that character is he's just totally outrageous, but he's a total performer, so he kind of wallows in his own outrageousness, which allows us in the writing to have a ridiculous amount of fun with him and allows the performer, as you can hear, to just totally ham it up. And the audience absolutely loves this character.
What's the actor's name?
The actor playing it is Chris Gibson, and he's amazing. And there's one scene in the show where he is playing three characters simultaneously. Mysterion, who you just heard, Ben Wilcott, who's the kind of hero of this story, a librarian from Flagstaff, Arizona, kind of a hero by circumstance. And then Jean-Pierre Desperrois, who's this Tunisian man, kind of the Han Solo of our story. You're not sure if he's a good guy or a bad guy. And for about 4 minutes in the show, those three characters are the only ones speaking in this like kind of fight to the death almost. And this one actor, Chris Gibson, it's not only does he vocally embody the characters, but if you watch him, he's switching physically between the characters, his posture, his gestures, his entire being as he, it's almost schizophrenic, you know, where he jumps back and forth between these characters. And it is truly a tour de force moment in the show.
The Zygonians have allowed me to rule all the Earth! Farewell! You'll never get away with this, villain! I do beg to differ. Desperrois, take us up.
As you wish.
Out! Molly here, climb on my back. I know it's not much, but if there's any chance of survival, it'll give you a few more seconds.
Jean-Pierre!
And which episode is that? I mean, I know you've made several of these. And how many are we going to see, actually, at the Redfern Arts Center?
So at the Redfern Arts Center, what you're seeing is the first installment in a trilogy. And each chapter in the trilogy stands alone so that you don't have to see all three. But yeah, the show runs about 2 hours with an intermission. And like Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, inspired by this sort of serialized cliffhanger style of storytelling. So once our story starts, it just continually propels you forward with this great mix of character and, adventure storytelling.
Well, Jason, it sounds like it's going to be a blast. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, my gosh. It is such a pleasure. Can't wait to bring the show to y'all.
Jason Newlander, he's producer, director, and creator of Intergalactic Nemesis, Target Earth. You'll see clips from his YouTube series and learn more about the upcoming show that's at the Redfern Arts Center. It's going to be on February 6th. All that at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for taking the time to listen today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And do us a favor, if you do like the podcast, rate it on iTunes. It'll help others find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.